T-Mobile has invested billions to light up America's largest 5G network, from big cities to small towns, including right here in yours. And great coverage is just the beginning. Right now, families and small businesses can save up to 20% versus AT&T and Verizon when they switch. Visit your local T-Mobile store today.
Plan savings with 3 lines of T-Mobile Essentials versus comparable available plans. Plan features and taxes and fees may vary.
Baseball is back, basketball is heating up, and the NFL draft is right around the corner. Listen to the latest on the teams you love here on the Odyssey app. The biggest sports radio stations in the country, providing unrivaled local coverage of their teams, all in one place. Exclusive interviews with players, coaches, and team executives, streaming live and always available on demand. Stay in the know with your favorite teams right here on the Odyssey app.
My new book, The New Climate War, sort of how we are now, we've arrived at this place where the impacts of climate change are no longer subtle. We see them play out in real time in the form of disasters that we're now dealing with. And that record hurricane season you guys just were with, 30 named storms, more than we've ever seen before in recorded history. There's little question now that the warming of the Atlantic Ocean, the tropical Atlantic, is providing more energy to generate more of these storms, and in particular, more of the extremely powerful and damaging sort of major hurricanes, Cat 3, 4, 5 storms. New Orleans, you know, you guys sort of dodged a few bullets this season, but, you know, that ultimately is, you know, pretty much every other city and community on the Gulf Coast are sitting ducks now for these ever more active hurricane seasons. So that's, climate change isn't literally causing the individual storms, but it is adding to their energy. It's making them more intense. It's providing more moisture, so they dump more rainfall when they do make landfall, and you get more of that compound flooding where you've got the coastal storm surge combined with the flooding inland and the backing up of estuaries. So, you know, that is a reality. We need to basically, find ways to be more resilient in the face of what is now an elevated hurricane threat along the Gulf Coast and certainly for New Orleans. But at the same time, we want to prevent this problem from getting worse. And that really means acting on the climate crisis. So while, you know, the impacts, all impacts are local in a sense, the fundamental cause of this is global. It's our continued reliance on the burning of fossil fuels for energy and transportation. Now, this next season, there's a little bit of good news. One of the things that contributed to this season being such an active season was a La Nina pattern, the opposite of El Nino in the tropical Pacific. And that influences sort of wind patterns, vertical wind shear in the atmosphere in the Atlantic region. And so the presence of a La Nina event this last fall added to the hurricane activity, but we probably won't have La Nina conditions this next season. So it probably won't be as active a season as the last one was, but we have to deal with the fact that global warming is making all hurricane seasons now more active than they would have been.
I am not trying to argue with you at all, Michael, because I am in total agreement. However, I know that the people that are listening in the audience are and look, rightfully so. If I make my living in oil and gas and I'm concerned that all of a sudden my livelihood is threatened, I'm going to be very concerned about this. And I'm also going to be concerned that, well, wait a minute, don't ask me to pay the price of this when, in fact, there are other countries that are as bad or worse than the United States. Why are you telling me now that, I'm 50 years old, I got to find something new to do or et cetera, et cetera? How would you explain that to somebody, or at least address that with somebody in that position?
Yeah, and 50 now sounds young to me. It's funny how things change.
it's all relative. We were talking earlier. Carly Simon, 75. Who'd have known, right?
Wow. You know, those are absolutely legitimate concerns. And I'm, you know, I live in a state, Pennsylvania, that was built on coal. It's actually where oil was discovered in this country back in the 1800s. And, of course, natural gas has become part of the current economy in this state. And I, you know, speak to people. I have kids in my classes who are, you know, who come from coal mining families. And so I'm very sensitive to that. Look, we need to make sure there are opportunities, especially for young folks who, you know, deserve to, you know, to have the standard of living or better standard of living than the generation that came before them. It's really important to make sure that people don't get left behind. But, you know, this has happened before. You know, the whaling industry ended rightfully because something better came along, you know, than whale oil, and that was fossil fuels. And now something better has come along. That's clean energy, and it's not destroying our environment and contributing to catastrophic climate change in the way that the burning of fossil fuels is. So we've got to provide resources, programs to help those folks who are, you know, already, as you say, sort of, older folks who, you know, might find it more difficult to, entirely change their line of work, their profession. We've got to provide them assistance, any assistance that we can. And we have to recognize, you know, it is important to note that there are far more potential jobs available in renewable energy than fossil fuel energy, because fossil fuel, mining extraction has become so automated that there just aren't that many jobs. There are a lot more potential jobs in renewable energy. But, you know, if you're not trained for that job or that job isn't, you know, in your community, it's not available in your community, obviously that's an obstacle. So we have to help folks out. We have to make sure folks don't get left behind because, frankly, you know, these people are heroes. The people who built, our economy here in Pennsylvania on the backs of, coal mining, they're heroes. We have to thank them for what they contributed, and we have to help everybody now move along.
And I want to drill down on that. When we come back, Michael, because I think, you know, if you look at it as an ecosystem, part of that are the people that are employed in those industries, and what are they going to do for their families, with provide for their families themselves, et cetera. And you got to maintain the dignity of work for them, and you can't just toss them aside. So I think if you're going to have a policy, whatever policy you have scientifically, there also has to be a corresponding economic policy to get everybody on board with the scientific policy, if that makes sense. We'll take a break, come back. Talking to Michael Mann, Distinguished Professor of Atmospheric Science and Director of the Earth System Science Center at Penn State University and author of The New Climate War. Back in a flash, WWL. We're talking to Michael Mann, Distinguished Professor of Atmospheric Science and Director of the Earth System Science Center at Penn State University and author of The New Climate War, about climate change and the Biden administration, the United States' role. And what I was getting at before, Michael, if you're going to draw circles maybe, before I can, and I guess it may be Maslow's hierarchy of needs, however you want to look at it, before I can worry about the climate, I have to worry about feeding my family, right? And then after I get that and then have a couple of bucks in the bank, then I can start worrying about other things, and the circle expands or triangle, whatever shape you choose. So I guess what I'm saying is, when it comes to getting people on board with this, I don't know if people are necessarily hooked on fossil fuels. I'm talking about the everyday person, yeah, as much as they are hooked on feeding their families, and rightfully so. So I guess what I'm saying is, how do you make this holistic? How do you get everybody on board with renewable energy, solar, etc.?
Yeah.
Again, because it would be the best thing for the planet in the long term. It would be the best thing for them in the long term. However, in the short term, they got bills to pay, family to feed, if you understand what I'm getting at.
Absolutely, Tommy. And, you know, we all have to be in this together, right? This is we have to see this as a battle to preserve this planet for, you know, our children and grandchildren. And I don't care who you are, you know, what your politics are, or what your opinions are. We all care about our children, grandchildren, and we want to leave behind a better planet for them. And so what we have to first of all, we have to frame it that way. We're all in this together. We have to help each other out because any transition is going to be tough, and we've got to help those who are struggling the most, in particular, get through this transition. But it's really important for us to communicate, to make it clear that this is win-win. This is better for everybody. A cleaner planet driven by clean energy, that's a world I think we all want to live in. And we have to also recognize the cost of inaction, because somehow, you know, as you say, when you're trying to put food on the table, when you're trying to pay the bills, you may not be thinking about it, but, you know, those devastating hurricanes, what happened to New Orleans, and climate change did contribute to the disaster of Hurricane Katrina. It didn't literally cause Katrina. It made it stronger than it would have been. It made it, the storm surge larger than it would have been. It meant there was more rainfall than there would have been. And as we know, there was enough of water to breach the levees. So we have to realize the cost of inaction is huge, but it isn't something that weighs on us necessarily on a day-to-day basis. It's something that happens in these catastrophic episodes like Hurricane Katrina. So we have to recognize that there's a real cost of inaction, but at the same time, that there's real opportunity here, right? That we can grow the economy, we can provide more jobs, and solve this problem at the same time. But it absolutely comes back to the point you made earlier. We have to help everyone along in this transition. We can't leave good folks behind. And that means thinking very carefully about how we transition folks who are in the fossil fuel industry so that they can continue to maintain their livelihood and the respect, the respect they deserve for the jobs that they have done to help us all.
Now, what about at the corporate level? How do you get the people in big oil or big fossil fuels on board with this? Because I would presume that they're motivated by profit, right? They need to have a planet upon which to make a profit, or you got to have somewhere to live, right? Or there's no profit. So how do you get them? How do you convert them to different forms of renewable energy other than fossil fuels?
Yeah, it's a great question. And, corporations don't have a conscience. They exist to maximize profit in general. That's what they see as their bottom line. And so it is really important to distinguish between workers in the fossil fuel industry who in many cases are the victims. I mean, I think about the coal miners who have sacrificed their lives, who died horrible deaths from black lung. They are the victims. The ones, if we're going to point fingers, it is, it has to be towards the executives who sort of knew better. And I'll use the example of ExxonMobil. In the beginning of my book, I quote from an internal report from ExxonMobil's own scientists back in the 1970s, where they referred to the potential consequences of climate change as catastrophic and warned of irreversible impacts if we continue to burn fossil fuels. That was ExxonMobil's own scientists in the 1970s. They knew what was going on. They were speaking up. They were communicating to, corporate higher-ups that we've got a problem. Unfortunately, those higher-ups decided to bury that report, get rid of that division, and instead double down in a campaign to sow doubt and confusion about the very science that their own scientists had internally confirmed. So there are some bad actors here who have made decisions that are bad for the rest of us but might have been helpful to them in maximizing their short-term profits. But look, at some point we have to stop pointing fingers. It's important to recognize where culpability lies, because that impacts the policies. And we do need to put a price on carbon, and we do need to provide subsidies for renewable energy. We do need to help society collectively transition fairly quickly away from fossil fuels. But we also have to make sure that we provide opportunities for these companies to remain energy companies, right? There is a future as an energy company, and those energy companies that make that transition the soonest and most efficiently away from fossil fuels to renewable energy are the ones who are going to prosper in the decades ahead. Those who double down on fossil fuels, they're going to be stuck with stranded assets because they're not going to be able to extract and sell their main asset, which is fossil fuels. And so those who get out in front, those companies and CEOs who get out in front, are the ones who are going to win.
All right, let me take a break. When we come back, I want to take a step back and explain how we got to where we are, how we changed the climate, not just the United States, but the world. And then how do you get everybody in the world? Because something else, I think, Michael, is that this has to be everybody on board. This has to be, I don't know if it's a United Nations-driven thing. I don't know how you do it, but Russia, China, India, but Brazil, everybody got to be on board with this. It's not Brazil, it's not the right country, but you know what I'm talking about. We'll be back.
Brazil, absolutely, yeah.
It is Brazil, yeah, I am right. Yep. Okay, 9:31, 29 before 10. Traffic now on WWL. 9:38, 22 before 10. Tommy Tucker, WWL, having an interesting conversation with Michael Mann, a distinguished professor of atmospheric science and director of the Earth System Science Center at Penn State University and author of The New Climate War. So the environment knows no borders, right, Professor? And when it comes to China and India and some of the big polluters, how do you make this a worldwide effort? Because just the United States in and of itself is not going to make that much of a difference, is it?
Yeah, well, the United States is one of the two largest polluters on the planet. China and the U.S. are the two largest. The U.S. is a larger per capita polluter, but China's got a billion people. They've got more people, so they're more total carbon emissions. Mm-hmm. But we live a more carbon-intensive lifestyle. So, you know, obviously there is a greater role for those countries who have contributed the most to the problem. And if you look at cumulative emissions, the total amount of carbon pollution put into the atmosphere, the United States is way ahead of China and everyone else. So we have this legacy, and we do need to own up to it. At the same time, as you say, this is a global problem. And going forward, the greatest threat to continued carbon emissions and climate change is the developing world. And so we need to make sure that the incentives are such that they don't choose to go down the same road that we went down. Because, again, something better's come along. We don't need fossil fuel energy now to drive a growing economy. Renewable energy makes a whole lot more sense and is being deployed, you know, increasingly here in the United States and around the world. There's more capacity added each year now in the U.S. and elsewhere from renewables than there is from fossil fuels. But, you know, this becomes a little tricky because some actors, you know, like us, we've contributed the most to the problem, but other actors like India and China are the greatest threat moving forward. And so it's a negotiation. There have to be incentives for them not to go down this road. There have to be incentives to us. And the greatest incentive, of course, is the fact that we're bearing the brunt of climate change-related damage every year now in the form of the unprecedented weather disasters. We've seen the wildfires out west, the hurricanes back east, as you have seen, and, you know, the flooding of the Midwest by a record derecho storm last year. The impacts aren't subtle anymore. They're playing out in real time. The damage is very real, and so we're paying that damage now, and it costs much less to move away from fossil fuels than it does to stay addicted to them. But we all have to come together, and here's the problem. The United States was in a position of leadership, you know, 5 years ago. Then under the Trump administration, Donald Trump became the only country in the world to withdraw from the Paris Treaty, which, you know, doesn't really send a message that the United States is willing to engage in good faith with the rest of the world when we're the only country that refuses to, it literally backs out of a commitment we had made. The good news is, you know, we now have an administration that is committed, you know, to leading again on this issue and to making sure that the world knows that we are ready to lead again on this issue, engaging in the necessary complex diplomacy that will be necessary to bring everyone on board and doing our part.
So how would we phase out from fossil fuels? How would airplanes fly? How would trucks travel on a road? I guess a truck might be an easier one than the airplane, et cetera.
Yeah.
Are there designs available for that now, Professor?
Yeah, it's a great question. And it's really important for us to distinguish between sort of the low-hanging fruit and the more challenging sectors. 2/3 of our fossil fuel emissions come from transportation, ground transportation, and electricity generation, industry. These are all emissions that we can immediately attack. We can bring, if we transition to renewable energy, renewable energy-driven grid, and we have electric vehicles, then we're charging our vehicles, including trucks, off of renewable energy. So there's a lot of low-hanging fruit. We can tackle, about 70% of the carbon emissions pretty easily. Then there are, on the other side, there are some difficult to decarbonize sectors right now. Air travel is one of them, right, because we just don't have the sorts of high-capacity batteries or high-density biofuels that would be necessary to do air travel without relying on jet fuel. But we're moving in that direction. And here's the thing. Air travel accounts for only 3% of global carbon emissions. And cement production is another difficult to decarbonize sector, difficult to make cement and concrete without without coal and without heating coal and giving off carbon dioxide. But again, that's down in the low single digits. So, yeah, there are some difficult to decarbonize sectors of the economy, but they're down in the single digits. And if we decarbonized everything else, we would be most of the way there. And we can recognize that while we get on that path and we get most of the way there, we continue to do research and development, and we will, soon enough have the technology to do air travel off renewable energy and sort of low carbon, climate friendly manufacturing practices when it comes to concrete and cement. All of those things are in the works, and those solutions will come. But in the meantime, let's decarbonize the sectors of the economy that we can, and not only can we do it, but we can create jobs at the same time and help save the planet.
Is part of this all or nothing at all? Because I know in your book you talk about flight shaming, and even with COVID, people get caught without masks.
Yeah.
And it seems as though some people use that as an excuse. Well, you see, he didn't do it, or he flies, Al Gore with his house, et cetera, et cetera. How do we get some kind of message across where people accept this and understand what a serious issue it is? Because I know I can understand the people that work here in oil and gas, and I would be the same way if my income depended on that.
Yeah.
But beyond that, if I could have a clean planet and cut down on these emissions and know that the planet's going to be sustainable for my daughter when she is my age, well, then, as long as right now is taken care of, I would be all for that.
Yep.
I don't understand where, like your book, The New Climate War, is it different than the old war, or are we making any advances? Are we getting more enemies? Talk about that, Professor.
Yeah, thanks. So, it is different. The old war was the assault on the basic science, climate change denialism, which was prevalent even just a few years ago, and some fossil fuel companies and lobbyists and front groups advocating for them in concert sort of with the conservative media did engage in this effort to discredit the science, to dismiss climate change as fake news, a term we've heard a lot recently, and to propose alternative facts, another term we've heard recently. And so the denial of climate change, is part of, this larger assault on facts, basically, that we have witnessed in a profound way over the last year when it comes to the coronavirus and the social distancing and lockdown policies necessary to, avert that challenge, to address that that health challenge. That was the old climate war. But the problem is for the fossil fuel interests and the forces of inaction, I call them the inactivists, as promoting their agenda, is that you can't deny the impacts of climate change anymore because people can see them with their own two eyes. People know something's going on. And so what's happened is some of these same fossil fuel interests, they haven't given up in their effort to keep us addicted to fossil fuels. Instead, they have shifted to a new set of tactics that are more viable in an environment where people know climate change is real. You can't deny it, But instead, they try to deflect attention, and this is something that you were just speaking to, away from the needed policy changes, the systemic changes, to individual behavior, as if the solution to this problem is individual behavior. Now, I would contrast that a little bit with, like, mask wearing when it comes to the pandemic, because you know, it isn't like there's a shortage of masks. That's not what's stopping mask wearing. It is individual behavior that really determines whether that can happen or not. But when it comes to the burning of fossil fuels, neither you nor I can, you know, impose subsidies for the renewable energy industry. Neither you nor I can put a price on carbon. Neither you nor I can create massive green energy infrastructure. We need our government to do those sorts of things. We need policies, and we need politicians who are willing to support those policies. And so it's been convenient, again, for the inactivists to try to divert our attention from, you know, the needed systemic changes, policy changes, which will, you know, it will hurt their bottom line. They'll make less profits. And so they've tried to divert attention to, oh, it's just about you and me becoming vegans and, you know, and not traveling as much. And by the way, if they can get us pointing fingers and carbon shaming each other, as you alluded to earlier, all the better, because then they divide the community of climate advocates and we no longer speak with a unified voice demanding change.
Let's approach it this way. People that are listening right now that are worried about their employment and their future, and I would be too, again, if it affected me.
Sure.
And they're saying not true, they're denying it, everything you're saying.
Yeah.
If we don't do anything and we continue on the course that we are on right now, what is the future going to look like?
Yeah, well, you know, the good news is that it isn't hard to see what that future looks like, because Hollywood has provided us some examples, some of the, you know, famous dystopian films. My favorite in this regard, early 1970s, Charlton Heston, Soylent Green, a movie I could watch over and over again. And if you watch at the very beginning of the movie, it was truly prescient. Climate change, global warming was cited as the reason for that dystopian future. I won't give away the ending, but Soylent Green isn't what you might think it is.
If you don't know the ending by now, shame on you, but I'll go along with you, Professor. But go ahead,
please. So Hollywood has presented us with these sort of apocalyptic visions that are not unlike a worst-case scenario. If we refuse to act, then those futures are certainly possible. At the same time, if we do act now, a far more utopian future is still possible, where, you know, we have a green energy-driven economy, jobs for everybody. I mean, that is still within our reach. It's all up to us. It's a question of whether we have the political will right now to act before it's too late.
In terms of, real quick before we let you go, I made the analogy with COVID, where when it comes to, you know, we have a big restaurant industry here.
Yeah.
It's not fair to ask restaurateurs to bear the brunt, the economic brunt of keeping people safe by limiting how many tables they can serve, social distancing, et cetera, when it's a public health concern.
Yeah.
And therefore, I think they should be compensated to stay closed. I mean, we pay farmers not to grow certain products, right? So along those lines, that to me is going to be an important step here, where people are compensated for the transition, where they're
absolutely
not afraid of it and not opposed to it.
Absolutely. I think that's critical. You know, when I say we have to help folks along through this transition, that's what I mean. And not only, you know, you can give people a cash handout, but, you know, that doesn't necessarily help them maintain their dignity and their self-satisfaction. So we need to be thinking about that as well. I will say that it would be tragic if the New Orleans restaurant industry went out of business, because it's some of the best food that I've ever had.
You're right there. Thank you, Professor. I appreciate your time. I hope we get to talk to you again, okay?
I look forward to that. Thanks so much, Tommy.
Thank you, sir. All righty, Michael Mann, Distinguished Professor of Atmospheric Science and Director of the Earth System Science Center at Penn State University, author of The New Climate War. Look, I get it. I understand if that's how what you depend on for your livelihood. At some point, though, you do have to look at the science involved and wonder about what kind of planet you can leave for your kids and your grandkids, right?
We really need new phones.
T-Mobile will cover the cost of four amazing new iPhone 15s, and each line is only $25 a month.
New iPhone 15s? It's better
over here. Only at T-Mobile, get four iPhone 15s on us and four lines for $25 per line per month with eligible trade-in when you switch.
Minimum of four lines for $25 per line per month with auto pay discount using debit or bank account. $5 more per line without auto pay, plus taxes and fees. Phone fee at 24 monthly bill credits for well qualified customers. Contact us before canceling account to continue bill credits or credit stop and balance on required finance agreement due. $35 per line connection charge applies. See T-Mobile.com.
Protect your vehicle's engine with a full synthetic oil change and save with Mobil 1 at O'Reilly Auto Parts. Purchase 5 quarts of Mobil 1 full synthetic motor oil and receive a $10 O'Reilly gift card after rebate. See store for details. With your Mobil 1 purchase, you'll also receive 2x points during Old Rewards Bonus Points Month at O'Reilly Auto Parts.
O'Reilly Auto Parts.